Okay, first question is, you kind of took a circuitous route from when you were with the Kentucky Colonels to the Denver Nuggets with the Baltimore Claws. Can you explain how that kind of weird kind of you going there and then coming to the Nuggets thing happened? Because it didn't involve money.
Well, it involved you have to remember that that was kind of the end of the ABA era, and there were a lot of teams that were struggling financially, and Dave DeBuscher was then the commissioner of the ABA, and he basically gave the Memphis franchise to a couple of fellas in Baltimore. And so the John Y. Brown, who owned the Colonels, of course, he started Kentucky Fried Chicken and was later governor of Kentucky. We had just won the ABA championship, and he had still lost money, so he got the idea that he was going to sell some of his assets to help make up the deficit. And so I was basically sold to the Baltimore Claws.
Oh,
And
geez.
I've heard for a couple different amounts. I've heard 350,000, and I heard 500,000. So I don't know which one is accurate, but it was in that range. Unfortunately, the two fellows that the Commissioner DeBuscher gave the team to in Baltimore didn't have the financial wherewithal, and so John Y. We announced that I had been sold. Well, I don't know if they said sold or traded, but it was sold for to the Baltimore Claws, if you can believe the name of that franchise. But 10 days later, he hadn't received his money, and he was taking a pretty good licking in the Louisville media. And so he showed up at the hotel I was staying, my wife and I were staying at, in Baltimore, and said, if I get you out of here, will you say some nice things about me in the Louisville newspaper? And I said, a deal. And so Marvin Webster, who had been a draft choice of the Nuggets, had come down with hepatitis. And so I guess either Carl Shear called John Y. or John Y. called Carl Shear, and I came to Denver for the same amount of money that I was supposed to go to Baltimore for. The real tragedy in that whole story is that to make the deal look somewhat legitimate and to keep the franchise, the Baltimore franchise, at least afloat, it was announced that I was traded for Dave Robish. And poor Dave had to go to Baltimore, and a couple of weeks later, that franchise wound up folding, and I think they played three exhibition games, but never played a regular season game.
That is fascinating. That is definitely one of the fascinating parts of the end of the ABA, because you had all these teams folding, and I'm really surprised, as successful as the Kentucky Colonels were, I'm surprised that they weren't among the teams destined for the NBA. Because
Yeah,
you guys.
well, to carry that thinking a little further, that John Y. Was going to sell an asset to make up the difference for the money he lost. In the negotiations of the merger, John Y. made the decision that it would be better to sell his players because the ABA teams that weren't part of the merger, that were still in operation, got a chance to sell their players to the NBA teams, and they had a draft. And Artis Gilmore was the plum of those players, and I think John Y received like $3 million for artists going to the Bulls. So the fact that, you know, he chose to sell all of his players and not be part of the merger was just kind of him following through on what he started by selling me.
Well, that was a good Kentucky. I mean, you when you guys won the championship the year before this, you, Louis Dampier, who was, I guess, one of the more underappreciated players in basketball history, and Artis Gilmore, of course, you know, made it into the NBA with the Bulls. And I think that when looking back on it, that, let's see, Hubie Brown was the coach, right?
Yep. It was certainly the best basketball team I ever played on. Yeah. And you know, there's not very many teams that can say that they had four Hall of Famers on the team at the same time, with Artis and Louis, and of course Hubie in as a coach. So it was a great team, and I think we would have had, seeing the success that we had with the Nuggets here, the first few years we were in the NBA, I think that, you know, the Colonels certainly would have been on that level.
I there's a new book out. It's called Tall Tales and Short Shorts, and it's all about basketball in the 70s. It's written by a guy named Adam Cribbles. And he was this kind of, if you come to Pep Center this year, I'll have to give it to you. It is a fascinating book, just all about the NBA and the ABA in the 70s. And it's kind of was the inspiration and the genesis of me writing this article. And it's fascinating to see how this Nuggets team evolved, because I think the year before you came here, Larry and Doug Moe came with, and he brought Matt Calvin, and I think Bobby Jones was drafted then. And
right.
completely transformed the team. They went from winning 37 games to 65 games in a short time span. And
yeah, if I'm not mistaken, that year that we won the championship, didn't they have the best record in the ABA?
They did, and they lost to Indiana, I believe.
Yeah, the Pacers in the semifinals, and then we beat the Pacers in the finals.
Yeah. And it's George McGinnis, the guy who stacked it in later with you guys, but was a big part of that team, that Pacers team. And it's funny, because one of the reasons I kind of like progressed this direction is when you kind of got to the Nuggets, you know, you were there with Larry Brown in his plaid suits, and got all the different wild aspects of the Nuggets with Chopper Travellini and the wildness that was the NBA. When you first got to Denver, was your impression, I am on a winning team, or was it just getting over the fact that you were traded and from a place that you had just won a championship?
Yeah, that of course took a while getting over after after 4 years at the University of Kentucky and 5 years with the Colonels. I was foolish enough to think they couldn't have a team in Kentucky without me being a part of it, and I found out very quickly that I could, even though the Colonels were gone a year later. No, I was. I thought after 10 days in Baltimore, I thought I had landed in heaven, because the Nuggets did have the best record in the ABA the year before, even though it didn't result in a championship. And so, no, I knew. And, you know, of course, we got David. And I knew that we were in great shape and we're going to have a good basketball team.
When David Thompson was first drafted, did you get the impression immediately when he joined that he was going to be a special player?
Yes, no question about it. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I've said if David hadn't had his problems, you know, people would still talk about David as in terms of you know, one of the best players that ever played the game. I mean, he was. Yes, he was phenomenal. You knew from day one he was going to be a very special player.
I mean, I think was it Larry Brown famously said later on that he didn't think you could your best player on your team could be 6'4", which is a strange quote. But Larry Brown has I'm finding out more and more said a lot of strange quotes. But there is you don't have to go into it if you don't want to. But that last year with Larry just seems extremely bizarre. But they that point with coming back to Thompson, that point was seeing someone who was, as I think I see a quote from you was saying like, maybe not you or someone else. Oh no, it was Bill Walton saying that he was Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan was around. It was in the 70s. Did you think the NBA was ready for that type of talent? Because Dr. J was 6'7", but he was a small forward, and that was more traditionally one of those premium spots, but never quite like a two guard being able to jump a 64-inch vertical, right?
Right. Yeah. David certainly was special. I mean, not only could he jump, his vertical jump was phenomenal, but you know, he was a great basketball player even without that talent. I mean, he mm-hmm. could he didn't have to get to the rim and dunk to score. I mean, he could score in any number of ways. And so, you know, he was I think he was a player that you know, people hadn't seen. You have to remember, before the ABA came along, I mean, the NBA was just kind of a, you know, shove it inside, get to the hoop, you know, good shooters, but not great shooters. And when the ABA came along, they really opened up the play, and it was, in my mind, a much more entertaining game to watch because of up and down, especially here in Denver, up and down style and shooting the three-pointer. And, you know, I think the ABA helped transform basketball in the NBA in a lot of ways, and David was certainly part of that.
Well, this, something that you were specifically a part of was basically I think you were technically the first stretch five in the league. I don't remember ever seeing anything about a player who shot like got a lot of his points on the perimeter. And what did you describe your head fake as? An eighth grade head fake?
If they had ever stopped going for that head fake, my career would have been over very, very quickly. But you know, I kind of did that out of just surviving, because you know, there was no way I could go inside and play against the more physical centers in the NBA. And so to take them outside and to have them do something they weren't comfortable with or accustomed to was kind of my way of surviving in the league.
Did you, when you developed that, was it a conscious, you know, outside of, you know, really developing that thing? Because you at Kentucky were playing the small, the power forward spot. Did you have to readjust coming back to Denver when you were the center? Because Nugget, it's quote unquote small ball with you and Bobby Jones as the front court. I mean, both of you 6'9". Was that an adjustment to kind of switch positions from power forward back to center?
Yeah, not really. Where that all started was at the University of Kentucky. Coach mm-hmm. Rupp would start every practice with a half hour of shooting. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't take a shot and visit with your buddy. It was, first of all, there was no talking in a Coach Rupp practice. Yeah. And you know, you shot the ball and ran after it and dribbled it back out and shot it. I mean, it was a pretty good workout for a half hour. And so, you know, it got pretty boring just shooting bank shots around the rim. And so that's where I developed the ability to, you know, hit the 15 to 18 foot jump shot. And so I always had that in my repertoire. And so, going from power forward to a center. It was a bigger adjustment on the defensive end than it was on the offensive end.
Well, you guys ended up getting, when your first year, you won 60 games, and it was the ABA was basically decimated by that point because of all the teams folding. And I think, was there 7 teams or 8 teams left in the ABA by the time the last year of the ABA?
7. Yeah.
And you all played 84 games, which
right.
a lot of people don't realize that the ABA played 2 more games than the NBA.
Yeah, and let me tell you something. They didn't change the travel schedule. We were flying. I saw a quote from Charles the other day about the poor babies mm-hmm. can't play back to back games. We flew coach. Not first class. We flew coach, and I remember one time we played 3 games in a row, not 2 games in a row, in 3 mm-hmm. different cities. So, I don't have too much sympathy. I mean, when I see somebody miss a game for rest, I laugh out loud. I mean, it's pretty ludicrous where that has all gone.
Well, see, even just as a side thing, can you imagine when you were coaching, resting players, just saying, just don't play tonight? I mean, something's always gone on, but I mean, it's like, it's kind of anathema to me to see LeBron James basically taking 2 weeks off in the middle of the year just because he wants to rest.
Right, and if you look at the minutes played back mm-hmm. then. I mean, you know, most starters were playing 38, 40 minutes a game and playing back to back and flying coach. And so I don't know. I don't think anybody plays 38, 40 minutes a game anymore.
I believe Gallinari played 34 minutes a game, 34 to 35, and he led the Nuggets last year.
Right.
In minutes.
Yeah.
And that's just, I mean, to me, it's not what I grew up with in the NBA, and I can't. It's a brave new world. But you and I are probably. I talk to Scott Hastings all the time about this, and you know Scott, he's very opinionated about these things. And he said, you know, that he's one of the reasons he and I get along and have dinner a lot is because we both kind of think the same way. So if you could imagine the way Scott thinks. Coming back to what we're talking about, the last year in the NBA, you guys ended up playing, fast forward to the playoffs, the Kentucky Colonels in that, and it's a legendary rough and tumble series from the way people describe it. I obviously don't have experience viewing it, but what was it like playing your former team and kind of going through this kind of intense 7-game series with them?
Yeah, it was difficult. I a couple of things that I remember for that series. Of course, you know, guarding Artis was always very difficult. He mm-hmm. might have been. I played in an All-Star game for about 3 minutes against Wilt Chamberlain when Wilt was right at the end of his career. I guess Wilt might have been stronger than Artis, but there aren't too many players who ever played the game that were stronger than Artis. But so that was certainly a challenge. The couple of things that I remember distinctly was we played the first game in Louisville, mm-hmm. and I was introduced in the starting lineup. And got a standing ovation from the fans in Kentucky. And the announcer he was announcing Bobby Jones was a player to be announced after me. And mm-hmm. he kept saying, at forward, Bobby Jones. And the crowd was continued to cheer. And Larry wouldn't let Bobby go out on the floor. Bobby sat on the bench. I think the announcer must have said it 10 times. Before he finally came out on the floor. But it was a very physical series, and of course it was quite rewarding to beat the Colonels in that series. I thought at that point we had a real chance at the ABA championship.
Well, progressing to that, game six is one of the so it's probably painful for you, but one of the most remembered aspects of the ABA. And what are your specific, I mean, you guys, I honestly, based on the way people were describing, had probably the better team, but they had Dr. J, and he basically took over in game six, particularly in the second half.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What I remember most about that game was how physical it was. And John Williamson was a guard on that team, a very good guard. And he just started beating people up. And the officials let the game get more and more physical. But where we really lost that series was in game number one. And if I have my statistics right, Julius, as you said, Julius just kind of took over that whole series. And Julius, we lost game number one. We had the home court advantage. We lost game number one here in Denver, and Julius had 18 points in the fourth quarter going against Bobby Jones, who was, you know, arguably the best defensive forward in basketball at the time. And so, you know, we lost that game at home, game number one, and lost the home court advantage. But I remember game six being a very, very physical game.
Well, and they made a big comeback, and that kind of is like what cemented Dr. J, or Julius Erving's legacy, and then that kind of propelled him into what, you know, he became with the Sixers. And
right.
You guys took that. What always I admired about this, like reading up and really studying, is that you guys went into the NBA the following year, and it was difficult. I think it was like a $3.2 million fee for the Nuggets to pay, like the ABA teams, plus you were paying off the Spirits of St. Louis owners for perpetuity. And that you guys get in there and immediately win 50 games in the NBA.
I remember the NBA had a strange sense of humor. Our very first game in the NBA with the Denver Nuggets was against the Indianapolis Pacers. And I had played the Indianapolis Pacers 1,000 times during my ABA career. And that was the first NBA game was against the old ABA team. But that was a good team. You know, we won the Midwest Division. I think the first 2 years we were in the NBA, we won the Midwest Division. And that was very satisfying. Proving to people that the ABA wasn't a junior league. That by the time the merger happened, the ABA teams and players were equal to anything that was in the NBA.
Well, you come to the NBA and, he didn't earn the nickname Minister of Defense until he was in Philadelphia, but Bobby Jones became, I think, over time, kind of like that kind of glue guy that you always need on a team. And it seems like his influence was missed later on when Carl Shearer traded him. And do you think that... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, Bobby always got the toughest defensive assignment in a team of scorers and people who enjoyed. I heard the quote about Press Maravich one time when he was coaching Pete. He said the quickest way to get the ball back on offense is to let the other team score. And that was kind of our philosophy with the Nuggets. We didn't have too many outstanding defensive players, and so poor Bobby, he got the tough assignment every night. And you're right, when he left, we didn't have anybody who played defense.
That is it's fascinating, and it's watching the there's actually, if you go to YouTube, there's a ton of highlights of you specifically and David Thompson from 77 to 78 all over. There's one game, I think it's 78, you guys are playing the Sixers at home, and you had a big game, the Thompson had a big game, but I think the Sixers won that game when you guys are at home. But it's watching you guys play, it is fascinating to see just how talented those early NBA Nuggets teams were.
Those were really some good teams, and like I said, we had our shortcomings on the defensive side of the ball, but there weren't too many teams who could run with us and outscore us for sure.
What was it like to be? How do I put this? What was the Larry Brown experience like?
Larry is probably the best basketball teacher that I ever played for. I was blessed to play for some really, really good coaches. I mean,
yeah.
I think at last count, like four coaches I played for in college and in pros are in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And that's why I always thought Larry was better suited for the college game, because of all the great coaches I played for, he was the best teacher of the game. It was good playing for him. And as you said, he thinks a little different sometimes, but you can't argue with the success that he has.
This is very true. And my father wanted me to ask you this question, and if you would know, he wanted me to ask you, what the hell happened to Brian Taylor?
Oh, Brian. You know, Larry would always take chances on players that everybody else had kind of washed their hands with. I remember I played with a very talented kid by the name of Jim Bradley, who was from Northern Illinois, and he was on that championship team in Kentucky. But just a complete dope head. I mean, the guy couldn't get to practice on time, and he'd miss planes and miss buses, and just terrible, terrible situation. He was finally murdered after he was done with basketball. He was murdered in a bad drug deal in Portland. This kid could play. And Doug tells a funny story about Larry asking him, what do you think about bringing Bradley to Denver? And Doug just went off and said, no way, we don't want that kind of personality affecting our team, and on and on and on. And and Larry, after Doug went on and on and on, Larry said, well, he'll be at practice tomorrow. he'd already made the deal to bring him in. And here's the funny part. Bradley was late for practice the very first day he was here. But you can go down the list of people that were kind of at the end of their careers and run out of options, and Larry didn't mind giving them one more chance. But Brian Taylor was one like that. Brian Taylor was so weird. He wouldn't shower. I mean, he'd play 15, 20, 25 minutes, and he wouldn't shower. He would get to the locker room, and he'd put his street clothes on and head for the door. He was just you tell your dad, he was just one strange duck.
Okay, I appreciate that. There was always a big mystery, because he, like, quit mid-season, didn't he? Like, it's like the team was like a dispute or something like that. He's like, he claimed the Nuggets didn't pay him money.
And then he suddenly left. I don't know what that was all about, but I can tell you nobody was sorry to see him go.
Oh, well, you guys go through into the Western Conference Finals in 78, and, well, even the year before, you play the Bill Walton's Portland team that ended up winning the title. And you guys, the next year, I don't think anyone will look askew on the Nuggets. That Portland team was really, really It was one of the more unappreciated teams in NBA history, I should say. They were that good.
Well, you know, that was before Bill really started having the physical problems. I mean, Bill was probably, when he was healthy, Bill was as good as any big man that ever played because, mm-hmm. you know, he could score inside and rebound, but he was an exceptional passer, and he was great, and Clyde Drexler was on that team, and Maurice Lucas, and that Portland team that won the championship was a really, really good team.
And the next year, that in this book, and several people I've talked to agreed, the 78 Nuggets, all of them are saying they don't know what happened, but all of them said that you guys were the best team in basketball that year. And my dad, you know, as he, you know, I'm relying on my dad for a lot of this stuff, but he said what killed you guys was losing game two of that series, kind of losing that home court advantage. But everyone right. thought you guys were better than the Sonics. And did when you were winning that series, did you guys have that feeling too?
Yeah, I think, you know, those teams, 77 and 78, I think we all thought, you know, we were good enough. I think one of the things that hurt us is that, you know, we were an unconventional team. I mean, we didn't play the way most NBA teams played. And when you saw us every 6 weeks or every 2 months, you know, you couldn't make the adjustments that you had to. But when you played us in a seven-game series, you know, you could start making the adjustments to stop us a little bit offensively. We certainly thought we were as good as anybody, but that seemed to be a detriment when we started having to play people, you know, in seven-game series like that.
Well, it's quite fascinating that run from 74 to 78 is 65 wins, 60 wins, 50 wins in the new NBA at that 47. But you won the Midwest division both times. And I can't think of another period in Nuggets history. You go to the ABA Finals, Western Conference Finals, and make the playoffs every year. I don't know if I can think of a more successful period
right.
in Nuggets history than that period. And do you think, now coming to the end of 78, unfortunately things kind of fell apart in 78-79, do you think that a lot of people point to the trade of Bobby Jones for George McGinnis to be the kind of the stepping off point of where things kind of started going askew? Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah. You know, I love George McGinnis. I was just with George. I was just with George 2 weeks ago in Springfield yes. when he was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. And George was an unbelievable talent. I saw him, and he referenced this in his acceptance speech. I was in Freedom Hall when he was a senior in high school, and in a 36-minute game, no, 32-minute game, mm-hmm. he scored 53 points and got 30 rebounds.
Wow.
In a 32-minute game, and
wow.
what he did with the Pacers and with the 76ers, but George was such a physical specimen that and was so talented, he didn't have to work that hard at his game, and when the physical skills started to erode, you know, his game went downhill pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And that was about the time that he came to Denver, and he wound up, you know, having some physical problems, and then we traded him to Indianapolis, and he finished his career with the Pacers. But I would say that would have been a great trade for the Nuggets when George was in his prime, but you know, he was kind of at the end of his career. And we brought a couple of other guys in that were at the end of their careers and, you know, really didn't want to work that hard. And Charlie Scott was one, and Tom Boswell was another one. And we just, it was just, you know, and about that time, David started having his problems. So it was a combination of a lot of things. I think, was that the year we were 30 and 52 or 32 and 50, something like that?
Yes, that's the year that Larry quit midseason and Donnie Walsh took over.
I was blessed to play 25 years of organized basketball, 2 in junior high, 4 in high school, 4 in college, and 15 in the pros. Out of the 25 years I played, that was the only losing team I was ever on.
That's amazing. that's fantastic. That is, well, you, and how many games did you miss as a Nugget? 13?
No, bless you. For my whole career, I think I missed 24.
That is stunning.
Yeah, I never missed 2 games in a row, which is in a 15-year career. That's a pretty amazing record.
That is a tremendous. I think Andre Miller had something similar where he like started every game of his career too. I mean, it's a, you know, never got a DNP CD. He never got one of those. But I think that when you look at these Nuggets. I can't believe I forgot this. Tell me your recollection. And I, by the way, I appreciate you indulging me with this interview. I really appreciate it. What are your recollections of David Thompson's 73-point game?
I think it was the only game in my career that I had double-digit assists. I'm pretty sure that's true, because the story. David and Ice were fighting for the scoring championship, and our place in our place in the playoffs had already been settled, and so it was a Sunday afternoon game in Detroit. And we passed it to David every time down, and David shot it. Everybody on the team was, you know, hoping we could get the scoring championship for David, and he scored 73 points that game. San Antonio played that night, and Gervin, I think, needed 64 or 63 to win the title. And he got 65 points in the first 3 quarters.
Yeah.
So David lost the scoring championship to Gervin, but we certainly did everything we could to try and get David that scoring title in the last game.
That's such a fascinating battle too, because I don't think I've personally seen in my 30 years of watching the NBA basketball anything like that.
No, I was just going to say, especially, you know, on the last game of the season, and Gervin gets 65 in 3 quarters.
That's stunning. That is absolutely, well, David, I believe, had 55 at halftime, or 53 at halftime. And according to this book I'm reading, they started double and triple teaming him in the second half, and he only scored 20.
Right. Yeah, that's it took them a half to catch on to what we were doing, but they didn't want David breaking any records against them, that's for sure.
That last year, 78-79, obviously the only time, the only losing record. Larry was, every account I've had is not having a good time, and obviously it seemed like your personal relationship with Larry kind of frayed then, and he was constantly trying to trade people and whatever. Do you look back on your time with Larry and think, if we were able to hold it together and maybe some circumstances changed, that maybe those Nuggets, because I believe the Sonics won the title the next year. They played the Bullets again, right? It was like 2 years in a row they played. And do you ever look back on this the whole, you know, experience of like when your first year with the Nuggets to that last year when Larry left, where do you think that maybe if things went a little differently, it could have been the Nuggets winning in 79 instead of the Sonics?
Yeah, it's hard to single out one thing. If instead of saying it was Larry or trading Bobby or, you could point to a lot of different things. I think probably, unfortunately, and I'm so happy for him that he's got his life straightened out, I would say the biggest thing was David. Yeah. And what happened to him, because, you know, the following year, all those guys were gone. I mean, George was gone and Charlie was gone and Boswell was gone. And, we turned it around and had a winning team, but you know, if David hadn't had his personal problems, we would have contended for an NBA championship for several more years.
I fully believe that too. And everyone I've spoken to, I actually was talking to Sandy Clef about this, and he believes that you guys during that period, now he got here in 79, but from an outsider perspective coming to there, this Nuggets team was one of the best teams of the 70s that he'd seen that just didn't quite get there, you know, and it's mostly you guys like introduced the Larry Brown, Doug Moe, Dan Issel, David Thompson, Bobby Jones, the Nuggets introduced a style of play that the NBA had never seen. I think that part of the Nuggets legacy is what endures to this day.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the Nuggets and / ABA changed professional basketball anyway, mm-hmm. For the good in many aspects of the game.